This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. We're talking about the five operas in this season of the Santa Fe Opera, and our guest is Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled, now in its 18th year. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet on the Opera Grounds. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte.
So let's just talk for a moment about your book, Opera Unveiled, in its 18th season.
Yes, is that amazing?
18 opera seasons of this. How did you start doing this?
Well, I was lecturing at the Santa Fe Opera, and people would come up and ask for copies of my notes, and my notes are a disaster. So the little voice said loudly, said, maybe there's a book here. So I thought about it, and lo and behold, you know, the first year was a tryout, and we sort of did it, but in-house. Peter and myself, the two of us, we sat down, I researched the opera, wrote them up, and he produced the book, and we designed the cover. It was great fun. We did the whole thing together. And actually, originally, it was with Thomas Fitzsimmons. He was the first person, the poet, much loved in this town, and a publisher, so because I had no idea, you know, how to do a book. He and his wife, Karen, designed a couple of the original covers. That was the first 2 years. And then Peter, my husband, and I took it over, and we sort of rattled on every year. It's been great fun. I used to worry about what to use for the cover. You know, how do I choose one image that would sum up the season of the five operas? It's always been the same format, so the five operas of the Santa Fe season. But I stopped worrying because, lo and behold, in a very Santa Fe moment, the cover would always present itself.
Yeah.
You know, somehow it would just appear, and I'd say, oh, that's perfect, and we'd go with that. So that was the sort of how it got started. And then as time moved on, I realized that my focus in writing these five chapters should really be on the operas themselves, because when I write the book, it's still not clear from the production people, the director, and that as to exactly what they're going to do. It's still too early. Though I learned wonderful things, and my interaction with directors has been one of the most exciting parts of this job, I suppose, because some arrive with a very clear-cut idea of exactly how they want an opera produced and directed. Others will leave it to the performers in many cases. I remember with one opera, there were two leading ladies, a soprano and a mezzo. The soprano knew exactly, instinctively, what she needed to do, so the director just let her go. The mezzo was a younger singer and a little newer who needed direction and a little hand-holding and that feedback. That was fascinating. So that's what I learned as I went on. But when I write the book, I typically just write about the opera itself. And then when I talk at the preview buffets, every night before the performances, then I've spoken to the directors and I hear what their point of view is, which sometimes does need explaining. Sometimes it may not be the exact setting that you anticipate. For instance, this opera, Romeo and Juliet, the opera of today, is not set in 14th century Verona. And why is that? And what's the director's thinking? So all of that goes into the preview buffet lectures. But in the book, it's the background of the operas. And actually, I take the books with me on the road, and they sell very well at the Met, and I tell people about Santa Fe, and they come to Santa Fe after I give my lectures there, which is really nice. So it's been great. It's a lot of work. I mean, it takes a year. Now, from the time of the press conference announcing new operas, then I do the research. I do a lot of research. I do a lot of listening. I listen to CDs or just the music without DVDs, without the images, because I like to see that in my head. And then I follow with the libretto. You know, I read the words and listen to the music rather than having the whole thing spelled out for me in a visual form. So,
very interesting. So all of this goes into the book Opera Unveiled, which is available not only at the opera but locally at Collected Works Bookstore, I think, and some
Garcia
of the places.
Garcia and the museum shops, yes. Yeah, it's out there, but the opera shop, which is now transformed, this beautiful shop. So when you go to the opera, you can go before, during, or after the show, visit the shop, and my book will be there, which is great.
So we're talking today about Romeo and Juliet by Gounod, and that is an opera, well, obviously inspired by Shakespeare, but there's a lot of
a lot of sources, a lot of background to this opera.
Yes, yes. When you take a Shakespearean play, which is perfection in and of itself, and attempt to set it to music, that is a challenge. First of all, Shakespeare is magnificent about developing characters and lesser characters and side plots that all build and lead into the main plot. In opera, you really can't do that. Opera has to have a fairly direct A to B storyline without too many side plots, without too many monologues, though they can become arias. So with Romeo and Juliet, the two great operas on this subject are one by Bellini, I Capuleti e Montecchi, the Capulets and the Montagues, and he did not stay close to Shakespeare at all. I mean, he took a lot of liberties. With Charles Gounod, he and his librettists did stay fairly close to the plot. A few things are changed. Some characters have gone. There's one new character. But the storyline, the simple direct line, is very direct, and it's very easy to follow. So their focus is on Romeo and Juliet, not so much the family feud, the characters, the fathers, even the mothers. They've all gone except for the Capulet father. They're not in the opera, which is fine. So they've not really taken a lot of liberties. It's been done many, many times. I mean, this story lends itself timelessly, universally to the telling of the tale in music and ballet. There's an absolutely gorgeous ballet score by Prokofiev on Romeo and Juliet that's haunting. In our time, there's West Side Story. Leonard Bernstein took the story and mixed up the jets and the sharks, and there you have the Romeo and Juliet tale. The great movie, of course, was the Franco Zeffirelli movie with the Rota score of the very, very young Romeo and Juliet. They were young. She was 14 years of age.
Well, and the Leonardo DiCaprio Claire Danes.
Yes, I saw that.
Which I have to say, I liked that one a lot. It was set in completely modern. I think it was like filmed near Mexico City or something like that. It was right. Huge buildings and stuff. It was fantastic.
It was. And I think if you want to, I mean, this is something fun to do. I always find, because it helps with one's enjoyment of the opera, is to follow through on some of these sources. Read the Shakespeare again. Read it. Check out a DVD of a Shakespeare production. See the Leonard DiCaprio, Claire Danes. I mean, I loved her in that thriller series that she's recently done. I forget the name now, but there she is, Juliet. So it's popular. West Side Story, the name is Juliet, but it could be Maria. It works.
I suppose that when you're making an opera from a play, there's an analogous kind of paring down to essentials that you have to do. That's like when you make a novel into a movie. Like all the subplots that are in a novel, most of them don't end up, a lot of them don't end up in the movie because the movie has to be coherent. And in the same way, the opera is a lot more...
Much more direct.
Yeah, and really spare in terms of those kinds of plot details.
In terms of the story, Charles Gounod himself, I love this quote, he compared writing an opera to painting a portrait. He said an opera is a kind of portrait painting. It should interpret characters as a painter reproduces a face or an attitude. It should gather up and fix all the features, all the inflections, so variable and fleeting, which, taken together, form the individuality of the physiognomy that is called a person. But he realized that when we look at a Rembrandt painting, for instance, when you look at a painting on a wall, you visually can take the whole thing in. You're not just looking at Romeo and Juliet, but the entire environment surrounding them. Now, you can't do that in music. So music will take the description of the character and build it piece by piece, note by note. So it's a sort of a successive building of character, which is what he does in this opera. This opera is a little deceptive musically, I think, because it seems very easily accessible. It's filled with wonderful melody, and you can take it at that level, but there's nuance and subtleties that's very typical of French composers. They were viewed negatively for a while as sort of light and not serious contenders. But actually, in this opera, too, there are little themes. They're not themes like motives in Wagner, but they are there and they come back. And you don't have to know or look for them. I think instinctively one actually gets these. So by the end of an opera, the death scene, for instance, that music can tear you apart, though you may never have heard it before. It's because it's been woven into the fabric and you empathize. I mean, with that story anyway, the end of that story, we're all in tears.
Yeah, it's going to tear you apart no matter what.
Yeah. And yet it's a story, you know, about life. It's a story of youth and exuberance, of two young people wanting to live. And yet they must die. So it's, it has that tragic component.
So set the stage for us. Where does the Gounod Romeo and Juliet begin?
It starts just where Shakespeare began. Shakespeare begins with the chorus who give us the background and tell us what's going on in Verona in 14th century Italy. There's this feud, this blood feud between two families, the Capulets and the Montagues, that went on for a very long time. So they set this up for us, and the opening has this very dark feel to it. And in this production, it's really beautifully done. It's an interesting set. The opening set is sort of a mausoleum on a great curved stage with great tablets with people's birth and death names on it. And on the center of the stage, there are just two silver coffins, nothing else. But upstage, there are Romeo and Juliet standing hand in hand. This is a beautiful directorial touch, which I hope I'm not giving too much away, but to me it's so affecting. So the young pair are standing on stage. They are, and they're not really there. They can't yet be in the coffins because their story hasn't been told. So as the chorus is giving this background, you're aware of their being there, but not being there, which theater can do, and especially in our theater, this would be so beautiful. And then at the end of this long, sad sort of opening, the whole thing lightens up and we go to a ball scene. All the black funeral clothes that the chorus are wearing come off and they hang them on coat racks on the side of the stage. The coffins just glide out of the way and we're in a ball scene. It's a happy time. Lord Capulet is celebrating the birthday of his 14-year-old daughter, Juliet. He has arranged for her at this party to meet Count Paris. He has arranged this marriage. He's going to marry Count Paris. Now, she has had no say in this, of course. We're talking about 14th century Italy. It's an arranged marriage. The family think this is very appropriate. She can't say, no, I won't do it. But she really wants to live. And you sense that in this very first aria. She sings, Je veux vivre, I want to live. The opera, of course, is in French. And the French language lends itself so beautifully to this tale and to Romeo et Juliet. Juliet, as they are. Maybe we could hear a little of that first, Juliet's entrance aria at the ball, Je veux vivre, and on this recording it's Diane Damereau.
Je veux vivre dans le rêve qui m'enivre.
Juliet saying, I want to live. Little does she know, I mean, what what she means is I want to live and dance and be happy and have a life and not just necessarily be married to some old guy who I didn't even fall in love with or anything.
Exactly. She wants to be a teenager. She wants to live life. Uh-huh.
But what we know it means is she wants to live at all.
Yes, that's right, because her time is limited. It really is in this particular piece. So that's the opening. You heard some of that exuberance from this great singer that interprets it so beautifully. Our Juliet will be Hélène Perez, who is having a marvelous career herself. She'll be a beautiful Juliet for
us. I looked her up. She's drop-dead gorgeous.
Yes,
she's in her 30s,
young.
So
she looks
will,
the part.
I'm sure, play the part beautifully.
Yes, I think so. So I talked with the director about what were his thoughts on setting this piece. Is he doing it in Verona? He said, well, actually not. He is setting this in the American southern states at the time of the Civil War. So before everybody groans.
So he saw Cold Mountain last year.
He did. A lot of directors seem to be drawn to this time period of American history for these European operas, which sometimes really is a problem. I do not have a problem with this because his point is very valid. He said this story of Romeo and Juliet is the archetypal story of a story within a story about sectarian conflict.
Yeah.
And that could be anywhere. I mean, I remember being so touched when I was in Ireland of a tragic story that still stayed with me of a young couple in Belfast. She was Catholic and he was Protestant, and they were caught in bed together and slaughtered just because they loved each other. It's the same story. Now, he said that's sort of, he wants to look at that context and said, don't forget that in the South, there were feuding families as well. I mean, they may not be Montagues or Capulets, but the families were at loggerheads. So that's the setting, which also allows for the gorgeous costumes of that period. And I think because this situation, all too sadly, is still with us, which is perhaps why this story will never end. I mean, it's timeless. As long as we have conflict between groups of people preventing young people from falling in love, their only crime is love. And they die brutally for it in many cases. This was the one that really sort of pinpointed that scenario. So this is how it would be in our production.
And so where do we go now? Juliet has said, I want to live.
Exactly.
And now Romeo says,
he shows up and he and his friends have gate-crashed the ball. They are the wrong family, but they want to see what's going on.
So it'd be like a bunch of Yankees crashing the Southern debutante ball.
Exactly. That's exactly what it was. But Romeo lays eyes on Juliet and it's love at first sight, of course. In opera, it has to happen very fast because you don't have very long. So he meets her and they have a rather little formal introduction to one another. He tells her how beautiful she is, and she's absolutely fascinated. The music is a minuet. In the Shakespeare, it's a wonderful dialogue. They're teenagers. They're getting to know each other for the first time. So there's a little sort of awkwardness about how you do that, and that's being carried into the duet. Then Tybalt, who is Juliet's cousin, bursts in and unmasks Romeo. He knows that he's there, and he denounces him as a Capulet, as a Montague. So suddenly she realizes that this is not one of her clan, it is one of the enemy. And at this point, the character of Juliet changes. Up to this point, she's been a partying teenager, this opening scene. But now when she sings C'était Romeo, it is Romeo, she knows, and she knows at once the trauma, the difficulty that will lie ahead, that she wants to get to know this young man. They're attracted, they're very drawn to one another, but he belongs to this family with whom there is a blood feud. Musically, Gounod does a marvelous thing in here. He takes the soprano's voice down to the lowest notes in her register as she says, C'était Romeo, and you know that there's something changing here. So Romeo is then hustled away by his friends, because this is a dangerous situation, and that scene ends. Then, of course, that evening he shows up under her balcony. The balcony scene is alive and well in this opera. It's a very beautiful scene where he compares her to it is the East and Juliet is the sun. The lines from Shakespeare, the sun is rising because she is rising.
So this might be a good time to hear a little bit of music.
Yes, the wonderful tenor aria L'œuvre 3, Au Soleil, The Sun is Rising. And in this cut, it's sung by Roberto Alagna.
Au soleil,
So that was Romeo under Juliet's balcony. At this point, Juliet comes out on the balcony and sings of her feelings, not knowing that Romeo is there. And she says, "What's in a name?" The famous line, "What's in a name?" And she comes to terms with that. She tells him that it's who you are that counts, not who your name is, who your clan is, who your tribe is, or which side of a war you might be on. That, I think, is what makes Shakespeare so incredible. There's this universality and real life situation. So they have fallen in love and decided that he can't stay long because they're searching for him in the grounds, and Gertrude, who is Juliet's nurse, is keeping an eye out for them. But they decide they'll be married at once. So Romeo will go to Friar Lawrence, Père Laurent, because this is a French piece, and the friar, he asks them to marry them, and he agrees that he will. This is a man who believes that by wedding these two quietly, it may help to heal the blood feud between the families, but of course it does exactly the opposite. So they... soon after, Juliet arrives with Gertrude, and they have this lovely, very beautiful wedding ceremony. Shakespeare didn't do this on stage. He had his wedding off stage.
Right.
And one of the reasons for this is that the clergy were not allowed to represent church services or rituals on a stage. It had to be off. But not so with Gounod. He couldn't miss the opportunity to have the wedding. And every one of the famous lines, they repeat in a beautiful chant-like way of singing. Gounod was a very religious man. He loved the music of Bach. And you'll hear some Bach in this wedding ceremony. And the whole thing culminates then in a quartet between Romeo and Juliet, just married, Friar Lawrence and Gertrude, before Gertrude hurries her away. And the idea is that Romeo will come to her that night.
So, okay, you've said a lot of plot. What are we going to hear now? Are we going to hear their wedding?
Yes, and then, then there's a little more story. The great fight, Romeo is on his way home, he's ecstatic, he comes on a fight, the two families are fighting in the streets. He tries to stay out of it, he sees Tybalt, and he will not fight him, because technically now they are cousins by marriage, but he can't tell him that. However, Tybalt kills his best friend, and then Romeo is so incensed that he kills Tybalt, and there's a bloodbath. The prince of the region comes on, the duke, actually, and he says, "What's going on? This bloodthirsty family, this has got to stop." He hears what happens, and he banishes Romeo from Verona on pain of death. If he doesn't leave the city now, he's dead. So he takes this this punishment, but he is not directly leaving. He goes to Juliet for the wedding night. And there's this amazing scene. In this opera, there are four extraordinarily beautiful love duets between this young couple. And I'm going to play you a little section of one. They spend the night together. They discover the joy of love, but then the pain of parting. That line, "Parting is such sweet sorrow," comes from this. They hear birdsong, and Romeo says, "It is the morning lark, I have to leave." And she says, no, it's the nightingale, you must stay, you can't go." But he must leave. So let's play a little of the love duet at this point. This is near the end of it, when she has realized, yes, he has to go with the dawn, the daylight. If he's discovered, he'll be killed. So they sing this duet together.
Oh, dear.
Romeo and Juliet and a little bit of suspension of disbelief that these are teenagers singing, but it goes on from here.
But the singing is gorgeous. The music is absolutely gorgeous. Listeners may have picked up this is a different Romeo in this cut. The first one was Roberto Alagna. From now on, I'm playing actually a really beautiful recording with Franco Corelli and Mirella Freni, conducted by Alan Lombard. It's an EMI classic recording. So here you heard part of one of the four great duets in this opera. So he leaves with the dawn and just in time, because Gertrude, the nurse, comes to Juliet and says, Juliet, your father's coming to your room. He is telling you that today you are getting married to Count Paris. So there's consternation. She's only just got married to Romeo and had this passionate love night, and now she's got to get married again. So she's in tears. She begs her father, no, I'm too young to get married. I don't want to be married. Leave me alone. He says, no, this is my will. You will be married. And he leaves. He leaves her with Friar Lawrence. And she turns to the friar and she says, what do we do now? What do I do? I'll die rather than marry Count Paris. And he says, well, I have a possible solution if you are brave enough to follow it through. And he tells her he has a potion that he can give her. And if she will take it, she will appear to die for about 24 hours, about a day. She takes the potion, she will faint. It'll look as if the blood has run from her veins. But she must have courage. And in that time, the family will take her to the family crypt.
They'll steal her where she can run off with Romeo, who's been exiled anyway.
That's right. So the idea, though, is that Friar Lawrence is supposed to get a message to Romeo to tell him what is happening, and he must be there when she awakens or she'll be terrified. Juliet doesn't give it a second thought. She says, yes, give me the potion, I'll take it, and takes it. Shortly after then, Gertrude dresses her for the wedding, and there's an absolutely gorgeous wedding ceremonial scene, and she is led into the chapel or wherever they're going to have this wedding, and Count Paris is there, and he approaches during the ceremony to put his ring on her finger, and she collapses, and there's total consternation that Juliet has died. This 14-year-old has died, and nobody understands why. Last words are farewell, father, as she drops to the ground. And the chorus then wraps up the first act. It's not actually the first act, but we are doing the production in just two acts at this point when the break will come. So maybe we could play a little of the chorus here at the very end of this act, where in the middle of this incredibly beautiful wedding scene, the bride has dropped down dead in her tracks.
Great consternation. Yes. Juliet is dead.
Yes, and everyone's adrenaline is rushing with the potential tragedy. I love this moment of theater where everybody on stage thinks that she has died. and the audience are in collusion with Friar Lawrence, we know what's happening, which in a way makes it worse. We've seen her collapse. We know her father will never see her again, and she's going to be taken to the tomb. Though she's not dead, she's going to be in this terrible place. We know, but the people on stage don't.
And it's the end of Act One. You're listening to the Radio Cafe Opera Series with Desiree Mays talking about Charles Gounod, Romeo and Juliet. And Juliet has just seemed to die, and there's been great clanging of cymbals, literally.
A major chord, a major minor chord, the end of all that. So, well, you need a little time to recover from all of that. So the final scene then is set in the crypt. Back to the first scene in this production again, that big mausoleum, the big semicircle on stage with the two coffins center stage. And Juliet is lying on one. And the music here is quite beautiful. It's also a little reminiscent of Wagner, which you wouldn't expect with Gounod. The opening of Tristan and Isolde has this very sad music as it sort of contemplates the tragedy that is to come, the meditation on love and the sadness that Juliet is seemingly dead. She is there, and at the end of this very beautiful opening, Romeo comes into the tomb, and he is distraught. They haven't been able to get the message to him about the potion she has taken. He believes that she truly is dead. So he goes to her side and has this incredible moment of passionate despair. And he takes from his pocket a little bottle of poison and drinks. And no sooner has he drunk, of course.
He just happens to be carrying poison.
Well, he thought she was dead. He thought she really was dead. So he had planned to do this, to die by her side anyway, which actually would have been extraordinary because it would have got the message across to the two families, look what you've done. But he thought she was dead, so he wanted to die by her side. Takes the poison, and of course, no sooner has it passed his lips than Juliet stirs and awakens and is overjoyed to find him there when she comes out of this sort of deep, deep sleep. Romeo is by her side. And they sing of fleeing to the ends of the earth, of being together. And he cannot move, and he has to tell her. He tells her, I've taken the poison, and that our love was too much to hope that this could work and that it would happen. So she then takes from the little bottle and tries to drink the last drops, but there is nothing. She has hidden a sword in the dress. I don't know how she did this, since she's now buried. But she has a knife, and she kills herself. But the difference from the Shakespeare here is that in Shakespeare, one comes, Romeo dies, she wakens, and then she dies. Opera can't do that. You have to have a duet at this point. It's not a very long duet, but they have these moments together where he is already dying and she realizes what's happening and then she kills herself and they die. And then in different productions, the ending can be where the families come pouring on stage and realize with horror what's happened when they see them, or they are just left alone, alone on stage, and we don't need to be told what's happened. And I think in this production, it'll be so beautiful for having gone from that very first scene where we've seen them upstage alive, holding hands, we're hoping that life will be great, and then the final scene where they're actually dead in the two coffins on the stage. So that's the great classic story.
And now we will hear their final duet. Is that right?
Yes, these are the final moments of the opera.
Yeah.
And that brings us nearly, not quite to the end of Romeo and Juliet by Charles Gounod.
And the tragic story, familiar to all, and yet we just keep on reliving it over and over in so many different genres, in so many different ways.
That's true. That's true. We have a marvelous lineup of singers at the Santa Fe Opera this summer. Aileen Perez and Stephen Costello sing the two lead roles. These are two young singers who really look the part and who are really into the romanticism. This is the ultimate romantic French tragedy that's out there. They will sing the leads. Emily Fons, who last year sang Ruby with such success in Cold Mountain, returns, and she's singing what we call a pants role. She's a girl singing in pants, trouser role. She's the only character that doesn't appear in the Shakespeare, actually. She says a little aria.
Right. She was made up for this.
She was made up for this. And then there's a rather special event happening in this opera in terms of casting. The very famous Denise Graves, who sang here many, many years ago and is a superstar in her own right, is returning on this, the 60th anniversary of the Santa Fe Opera, singing a little cameo role. She's singing the role of Gertrude the Nurse. So that's going to be quite something. Nice. We have some wonderful, famous singers who are coming back to be part of the 60th celebrations. Stephen Lawless directs, and Harry Bickett, who is the chief conductor for the Santa Fe Opera, will do a wonderful job with this. He's a fine conductor, and this is a beautiful piece. So that's it's something actually that is going to be offered on family nights, Mary Charlotte, the Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, we have not yet talked about some of the special nights that the Santa Fe Opera has. The family nights are an opportunity for people who can't or don't want to pay full price for the opera to bring family members. Is it a full-on dress rehearsal?
No. It used to be we did the final dress rehearsal was called Youth Nights. You could come with family to that for a nominal charge. But these are fully-fledged live performance nights. And actually, I applaud that. I think if you're bringing kids for the first time, give them the whole experience.
Yeah.
Though I must say, with the final dress rehearsal at the Santa Fe Opera, I've rarely seen it stop. I've rarely seen the conductor or the director stop for any reason. They take endless notes, but the thing goes through from beginning to end without a break. And then everybody goes up on stage afterwards, the cast and the musicians, everybody stays, and they go over the notes, and they're there till the early hours of the morning. So, but in this case, the family nights, the opera is offering two nights for each opera. So there's plenty of opportunities. The only thing is the number of seats are very limited. It's like getting frequent flyer miles on an airplane. You have to book early. So if anybody would like to go ahead, and this is a perfect piece for young people, for kids, for teenagers particularly, who are in this age bracket, there will be two full performances of Romeo and Juliet and the other operas. You have to call the box office and ask about that. One adult pays really a nominal amount and the kids pay very little as well. But the box office will give you all of those details at 986-5900. So I would encourage people, don't miss this. It's a very beautiful piece and it can be life-changing for a young person to be introduced to the right opera at the right time in their childhood.
One thing that I think is also interesting about this opera and about Shakespeare's play is that it reminds us that those great emotions that you might have felt when you were 14, 15, 16, 17 years old are real. And a lot of adults dismiss love that happens at that age as being immature or unreal or some kind of projection or fantasy life or whatever. But it turns out, especially in this day of Facebook, a lot of people are re-meeting their great loves from their teenage years.
First love, you know.
Their first loves. And those things are as real all those years later as they were at the time.
And sometimes I think maybe people dismiss them because they're often so painful. First love, how often does it actually work out? I mean, you don't have to go to the lengths these two do to die, but that happens too. So it shouldn't be discounted. And I think you've touched on a point, Mary Charlotte, that as to why opera is relevant. You know, a lot of people think, oh, it's set in other countries and other times and places, and we have no frame of reference. I mean, it doesn't mean anything to us where we are now in the 21st century. Not true. You know, emotions have not changed. We still fall in love for the first time. We get hurt for the first time. And no matter what you're wearing, the clothes or the costumes or the scenery, whatever it is, the emotions are the same. All opera is about this. Shakespeare was part of the reason of his super genius was he seemed to be able to cut through time, space, and the universe without even knowing of these other lands and countries and got those messages of human feelings and emotions across. It may be love, hate, revenge, all of the big emotions. They are blown up a bit in opera, I do admit. but it's also true the more you are exposed to it, the more you hear Romeo and Juliet, the more you will identify with the passion, the love, and remember one's own first love. It brings it all back. It does. Now, so for some people, that may be hard. But for teenagers who are getting into that stage, too, it may be reinforcing. It may be wonderful. I mean, how many teenagers have said, what's in the name? It doesn't matter that my parents don't approve of you or vice versa. You know, we should still be able to be together.
Another thing that's great about family nights and introducing young people to opera is that it's really accessible because the opera, A, is so theatrical mm-hmm. that even whatever your relationship is to opera music and opera singing, the theater, the play is right in front of you, and there's subtitles right in front of you on the chair mm-hmm. in the next row, so you can read along with what's going on and not miss a single plot point. It's not like the old days where you had to bring the libretto and then the translation of right. the libretto that you were trying to read in the dark and all of that. So
right.
it's highly accessible. It's the equivalent of watching a foreign movie with subtitles.
Oh, I think it's better than that, actually. I used to have to watch a screen over the stage, which was really hard, you know, because your head's going up and down, up and down. You're reading the words, you're looking at the stage. That wasn't ideal. But we were one of the first companies in the country to do this, to have the translation on the back of the seat in front of you.
Is that right?
And the way it works is very simple. You just push the button and you will get the words that they are singing in English or in Spanish, we're doing it in Spanish, or you can turn it off. If someone says, I love you in opera, it's probably going to take at least 15 minutes to describe that in music. So you don't have to be reading it all the time. You can turn it off and just allow the music. That's why I always encourage people to know the story of the opera before they go. You shouldn't be struggling with story and who's related to who, especially in opera where it's often very convoluted. But if you have that down, you're not trying to intellectualize what's going on. The music is what it's about, and the music will tell you the story. It's been clear, I think, from the excerpts we played today, how that music tells that story. But it's there, and if you want to follow along in English or Spanish, in some of the European houses, they do it in many languages. If it's a Russian opera, you also get Russian. I mean, it's amazing. You can yeah. do that. But it's there. You can turn it on or off, but it certainly makes it easy. But ahead of that, I think it's good to know the story ahead of time so that you're open to the music.
Well, Desiree Mays, I want to thank you so much for being with us. And we've got just a couple of minutes left, so why don't we go out with there was one track that you had ready but didn't play, which was the Wedding Night duet.
Part of the Wedding Night duet, yes,
yeah.
Let's play that.
Okay. We've been talking to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller and author of the book Opera Unveiled. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. The Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org, and the phone number is 800-280-4654. The local number in Santa Fe is 505-986-5900. Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.